This is a region that is essentially the epicenter for tensions between India and Pakistan.
India makes a move for direct control of Kashmir State. It's Wednesday, June 27th. This is VOA Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Hello and welcome. We're also on Facebook at VOA Asia. Coming up, searching for trapped teens in Thailand. Moves are being made as trade threats grow. The business of tunnels and trees, washing more hands, and more melting ice. It's all on today's VOA Asia. India's federal government took direct control of Kashmir State last week after the ruling Hindu Nationalist Party ended its long-troubled alliance there with a Kashmiri political party. Political decisions will now be made by the government in New Delhi. Through day-to-day life, there is unlikely to change significantly for the people of Kashmir. India and Pakistan have fought two wars over Kashmir, which is divided between India and Pakistan, but claimed by both in its entirety. Rebel groups have been fighting against Indian rule since 1989. About 70,000 people have been killed in the armed uprising and subsequent Indian military crackdown. The rebels want Kashmir to be united under Pakistani rule or become an independent country. VOA Asia's Ira Melman got in touch with Michael Kugelman, the senior associate for South Asia at the Washington-based Wilson Center, to find out his thoughts on the situation.
It's very clear that Kashmir is a powder keg. This is a region that is essentially the epicenter for tensions between India and Pakistan. It is an area that is has a young, restive population that is very uncomfortable with Indian rule, particularly because Indian security forces have oftentimes used a lot of violence and repressive means to try to quell what India regards as a dangerous anti-state rebellion, but what Kashmiris regard as a very logical, justifiable fight against oppressive rule. And now, as you've noted, India plans to essentially step up direct rule, which could essentially empower security forces to take even more drastic action against Kashmiris, which would essentially play into the core grievance that animates the opposition and the fight of Kashmiri. So my bottom line is I think that this powder keg in Kashmir could well explode in the coming months. And it's true it hasn't gotten that much attention, but I think that we may be hearing a lot more about it for all the wrong reasons in the coming weeks and months.
How does this have an effect, or does it have an effect, on global politics and the geopolitical situation?
Yeah, so Kashmir is really at the heart of the dispute between India and Pakistan. It's at the heart of the fact that these two countries, don't have a peace treaty, that they are technically at war, could go back to war against each other whenever they want. I mean, it's when it comes down to the territorial issues, it's very hard to find compromise. And for India, and particularly for the current government in India, which is a pretty conservative, hardline nationalist government, it feels that there's no need to discuss the status of Kashmir. It is clearly India's, and it will always be part of India, whereas Pakistan says just the opposite, that it cannot and will not accept Jammu and Kashmir being part of India, and it thinks that, there needs to be an effort to open up a negotiation to discuss the final resolution for Kashmir status, which, of course, India doesn't want to do. And, there have been some calls by Pakistan that have been issued through the UN and other places for there to be international mediation to try to get the two countries together to talk through some type of negotiation to resolve the status of Kashmir. But India resists that because it feels that any time there'd be any sort of international mediation, that would mean that the Kashmir issue would be brought up, and India doesn't want it brought up. And I think out of deference to India, many countries, including the United States, have been willing to put themselves out there as potential mediators to address this this longstanding dispute.
Are there any other groups beside nationally sponsored groups that are taking part in this?
Well, I mean, there are a lot of non-state actors floating around in Kashmir. You certainly have some Islamist militants that have had connections to the Pakistani intelligence agency, But you also have indigenous rebel groups in Kashmir that have been fighting against Indian rule. And this is part of the problem, because it's sort of hard to tell sometimes who really has allegiance to who. And, you know, the Indians claim that the entire opposition in Kashmir, you know, all of these local rebels are in some way being funded or supported by Pakistan, whereas Pakistan says, no, not at all. You have an indigenous movement gathering force in Kashmir that's opposed to India and has nothing to do with what Pakistan is doing. So that's what makes this whole situation more complicated, because in some cases it's really hard to know exactly who's supporting who and, you know, where the allegiances lie. But at the end of the day, what you do have is just a lot of nefarious and opaque and tricky characters out there that certainly are very destabilizing, potentially.
VOA Asia's Ira Melman speaking with Michael Kugelman, Senior Associate for South Asia at the Washington-based Wilson Center think tank. These are among some of the top Asia stories you'll find currently trending on voanews.com. Flooding complicates cave search for Thai soccer team. EU and China to promote WTO rules upgrade. Men who investigated Ivanka Trump China suppliers off bail. U.S. aircraft carrier patrols disputed sea amid China buildup. Australia to buy 6 U.S. Triton drones for $5.1 billion. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on Facebook at VOA Asia. You'll also find them on our voanews.com website. We continue with VOA Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. The search is continuing for 12 Thai teenage football players and an assistant coach who went missing over the weekend and are believed to be trapped inside a nearby flooded cave near the Thai-Myanmar border. Steve Sanford reports from the scene where the search for the missing group is taking place.
Families and friends held vigils and stood firm as the search for the missing team entered its third day here in northern Thailand. It was a sleepless weekend for many of the parents gathered together under a shared canopy, waiting for word of their loved ones.
All the people here are very sad, and they come to support each other, cooking food and sharing with all the family and relatives of the missing kids.
Rescuers' teams have been working nonstop to reach areas in the cave now surrounded by rising water levels from the rains. An opening above the caves was discovered about 3 kilometers from the cave entrance, raising hopes for food drops soon.
Right now, we are worried about the kids inside, about the air and the rising water levels. But what we know is the kids are athletes, football players. They have strength, and they are used to the cave, as they have gone in and out 4-5 times.
Football has long been one of the sports favored by the community, and for head coach Naparada Kantawong, who missed the weekend practice, it's the team's strong bond that will save the group.
Their teamwork is very strong. Definitely they have this bond. And the leadership of the assistant coach will hold them together. My assistant lived and worked with me since we formed the team. He has got a good relationship, and the team loves him very much.
As the search continues deep inside the huge caverns, many are confident that the football team will be rescued before the weekend, as time runs out. Steve Sanford reporting from Chiang Rai, Thailand.
Happening now in Asia, at least 4 people were shot and wounded in Hong Kong in a crime that rarely occurs in the Chinese-held territory. 2 of the victims suffered head wounds in the shooting in Quarry Bay Park in eastern Hong Kong. The victims included 2 men and 2 women. Police arrested a female suspect. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're always happy to have you with us on VOA Asia. Thank you for listening. U.S. and European markets are cautiously watching as speculation over trade wars deepened worries across the globe. U.S. stocks fell sharply on Monday before making a slight rebound Tuesday. The United States is scheduled to start raising taxes on more than $30 billion in Chinese imports in 2 weeks. China has promised to retaliate immediately, putting the world's 2 largest economies at odds. On Sunday, President Trump issued a warning to the U.S. trading partners that unless they remove restrictions placed on American goods, they will face more than reciprocity by the USA. VOA's Lori London trades details of the topic with former Obama administration chair of Economics Council, Austin Goolsbee.
We definitely need to think through our strategy better than we're currently doing. And the example that I'll give you is I think the president is correct to be concerned about Chinese violations of U.S. intellectual property, if you want to call it that way. If you don't want to use the fancy term for it, there are Chinese companies that the Chinese government forces U.S. companies that want to sell in China to have a Chinese partner, and the Chinese partner steals the plans and then commences becoming a competitor, making a competing product. Okay, that's a big problem. If you want to address that problem, it's not Donald Trump is not the first president to think about that and try to address it. But the effective way to do it is to line up all your allies and go as a group and try to force a change in their behavior. But we haven't formed a group. We've ticked off all of our allies on that. So we're going to simultaneously threaten a fight with Canada, with Mexico, with Germany, with the rest of the EU, with Japan, and with Korea. And then we're turning and saying, now we're going to try to force China to do what we want. I think at this point, it's dramatically more likely that China goes to our allies and convinces our own allies to join China in filing a grievance against the United States than it is the other way around. And I kind of can't believe that I'm saying that, because historically that would never be true. Obviously, our own allies would be with us against the infractions the Chinese are doing. But we've opened the door for China in a way that threatens to be quite detrimental to U.S. national interests.
Because it would appear that this policy has the potential to fall apart dramatically. But we have an administration or a president that does not like to admit mistakes. It would seem more like he would rather dig in just to prove he's right, even if he isn't.
I hope that's not their mentality. We have seen numerous examples over the last year and a half, in which President Trump has tweeted out a policy that upon further examination or finding out that it's unpopular, they just kind of don't end up doing it. So they don't publicly back away or publicly say, oh, we were wrong. They just kind of don't proceed. And I guess my hope is that they do that. If this remained a small skirmish over some particular industry, the U.S. put in a tariff on whatever, on this special rolled steel, the Chinese responded by some specific thing, and it never went any more than that. The U.S. economy is so massive, is extremely resilient, that wouldn't be the start of a trade war, that we wouldn't be talking about a recession. That it would be a limited in nature. And we have done that in the past in the U.S. without too much detriment. If we can't contain it, if we can't stop the president from saying, you know, I'm going to do $50 billion, and then they say, well, then we're going to do $50 billion. And then the president tweets out, well, then I'm going to do $100 billion, and then they said $100 billion, then $200 billion, then they'll do $200 billion. If we can't stop that dynamic, then I really have some significant fears for the U.S. economy, but for the whole world economy, because you cannot have a shooting trade war, the U.S., China, and Europe, if those three big groups are going to be in an outright trade war, we will have a global recession. And I think you see the stock market reacting negatively over and over again in the U.S. whenever they perceive that the president is actually serious about starting a trade war, because the business people know that nobody wins a trade war.
Former Obama administration chair of the Economics Council, Austin Goolsbee, speaking with VOA's Lori London. Coming up, tunnels and trees are boosting Asian business. You're listening to VOA Asia.
From Pink to Pitbull, Beyonce to Bruno Mars, the hits live here on the Top 20 Countdown.
Hi, I'm Ray McDonald, and for the past 30 years, I've been counting down the very best of the Billboard Hot 100 Pop Singles Chart. The hit list never sleeps, so don't you miss a moment of the action. Join me every Thursday for the Top 20 Countdown, right here and worldwide on The Voice of America.
This news from VOA Asia. 15 people are dead after heavy rains triggered flash flooding and landslides in northern Vietnam. The Vietnam Disaster Management Agency says at least 11 other people are missing amid the disaster, which wiped out homes, crops, and roads. It's caused more than $6 million in damage. Visit VOA Asia Facebook each day. See and share our stories. This is VOA Asia. As VOA Asia continues, tunneling under Mumbai and climbing towering trees in Malaysia are the topics on today's VOA Asia Business Scene with Skylar Ogden.
A multi-billion dollar underground metro project in Mumbai, India, is expected to ease traffic congestion and provide a new link to the city's airports. The line will connect Mumbai's popular tourist destination of Kolaba to a special economic zone in the north called Sipes, and link the coastal city's busiest districts. But not everyone is happy about it. Stalin Dayanand is an environmental activist.
This is the oxygen cylinder for Mumbai, and this needs to be protected.
Environmentalists have gone to court to fight the construction, which they say will destroy thousands of trees and desecrate temples. They also object to plans to build a metro station on an 82-acre site in Airy Colony, a biodiversity hotspot. Further resistance on the project comes from the 7,000 indigenous Indians, the Wali, who live across Airy Colony. So far, their legal efforts have been unsuccessful. Despite the fight, construction continues. Advocates say the underground line will ensure Mumbai keeps running during the summer monsoon months when tracks flood. The new line also aims to ease the passenger load on the city's old railway lines by about a quarter a day. The $3.6 billion metro line will be completed in 2021. Deep in the greater Ulu Muda forests of Malaysia, towering Tualong trees hold a much-needed source of income for local villagers: bees. Malaysian Tualong honey gets approximately $38 a kilo. Abdul Samad Ahmad is a honey hunter.
The value of honey from the Tualong trees is high.
Ahmad has been harvesting honey like this for more than 20 years. After climbing trees that rise to 250 feet, he smokes the bees out by lighting a collection of vine roots. As the bees rush out, Ahmed collects the honey in a bucket. One tree might hold many hives, and the smoking out process can go on all night. The honey is then sold to local villages or to nearby traders. Abdul Samad Ahmad.
The value of honey from the Tualong trees is high. The honey is very nutritious. You can make all kinds of medicine from this honey. Medicine for coughing, cleaning wounds, and colds.
While demand for Tualong honey continues to be strong, its supply is limited. Now, because of logging and a declining interest amongst the youth, honey hunters seem to be a vanishing breed. For VOA's Business Scene, I'm Skylar Ogden.
This news from VOA Asia. Australia is buying 6 U.S. Triton remotely piloted aircraft to beef up its maritime patrols, with the initial investment of $1 billion for the first drone. The government said the Triton drones would be used for intelligence gathering and would improve anti-submarine warfare and marine strike capability. All the big stories come your way throughout the day on VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, hand washing is one of the easiest ways to prevent some diseases. But in refugee camps and temporary shelters, like in Myanmar and elsewhere in the world, providing access to soap, clean water, and sanitation can put increased strain on resources. VOA's Faith Lapidus tells us officials at the global aid agency Oxfam say they have a solution that may overcome some of those challenges.
Oxfam recently completed field trials in Tanzania's Nduta refugee camp for an innovative hand washing stand that is relatively cheap to produce and can cut the risk of disease.
We know that when people don't wash their hands, they are likely to have diseases like diarrhea and other water and sanitation-related diseases. It's been proven and documented that in such situations, diarrhea actually accounts for about 30 to 40% of death when they are not properly addressed.
In many camps, refugees make do with a jerry can suspended by a rope with a foot pedal to tip soap and water over their hands. In contrast, Oxfam's hand-washing stand holds 30 liters, is easy to use, and doesn't waste water.
Each wash with these taps uses up to 100 milliliters of water, very efficient. So you get around 300 uses, which would be a family of four using it for a week, actually, or groups of people, large groups of people using over a day. That means you only need to fill it once a day, which is important for management of something like a refugee camp.
It's also easy to assemble. It stands on sturdy tripod legs, has a drip tray and drainage system to eliminate puddles that attract mosquitoes, and the one-touch taps minimize the risk of contamination. Oxfam wants to see a hand-washing station with every plastic latrine slab they distribute.
From the supply center, we send out thousands of plastic latrine slabs every year for sanitation programs, and the issue for them is they don't provide immediate good quality hand washing facilities. Our intention is to have this ready to go so that when you order latrine slabs, you order this by default. So there's always going to be a hand washing facility where you're doing the latrine program.
Following successful trials in Tanzania, Oxfam is looking to start mass production later this year after another trial in Uganda. Eventually, they hope the cost per unit will be around $40. I'm Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
Once again, facts are supporting the claim that the planet is getting warmer. According to a new report published in the scientific journal Nature, Antarctica is losing ice so fast that by the end of this century, the sea level could rise as much as 16 centimeters. Now, that might not sound like much, but scientists say the trend is alarming. The rest of the story comes from VOA's George Pudich.
Daily temperatures everywhere in the world rise and fall according to the local weather, so it is hard to notice the average annual rise of a degree or two. But Professor Martin Siegert of Imperial College in London, the co-author of the new study, says when we look at the impact of rising temperatures on Antarctica, the picture is dramatic.
We're noticing the ice sheet being lost, reducing in mass. We're seeing wind patterns that are changing. We're seeing ocean temperatures increasing, ocean acidity increasing, changes to biodiversity. In fact, everything that we look at in Antarctica, and we've got records going back several decades now, are pointing to change.
Computer models based on more than 150 measurements made on the ground and from space over the last 30 years show an alarming trend. From 1992 to 2011, Antarctica lost an average of 76 billion tons of ice each year. But in the 5 years that followed, the annual loss nearly tripled to more than 219 billion tons.
So it's completely possible for Antarctica to contribute several tens of centimeters in this century.
Scientists say the main culprit is the release of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. But if we act now, there may still be a chance to reverse the trend.
And so we have to ask ourselves, is that the world that we want our future to be like? And of course, the answer is it can't be. It can't be that. And what we're saying in this paper is we need to recognize that Antarctica is changing and is heading a certain way. And we need to act now. Choices we make now are going to shape what the future of the southern continent is going to be like.
But some say it may already be too late. The study shows some of the ice shelves have been irreversibly lost, and the rise in acidity of the ocean water is likely to lead to the extinction of some marine life. George Pudich, VOA News.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. In addition to hearing our program, perhaps on your handheld mobile device, you can hear us on the radio and many great stations around Asia, like CCU Radio at National Chungcheong University in Taipei, Taiwan. We thank everyone there who has tuned in today. And if for some reason you've missed any part of our program, check out the entire program on VOA Asia Facebook or our website, voanews.com. We thank our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Kelvin Fowler, managing editor, Diane Gao, and our VOA Asia team, including Skylar Ogden, Ira Melman, and Doug Bernard. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. We hope you have a nice day ahead.